Looks like BP is making a change at the top.
But what can the company accomplish from that?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, July 26th. Reports are BP's CEO, Tony Hayward, will soon be out of a job, and his successor could already be preparing to take over.
And out of pages and pages of financial reform, perhaps a morsel of business prospect. Later. Hey, Bill.
Yes, Steve? Will
you be my friend?
Of course I will.
Great. That's going to be $40 an hour.
What the? Huh?
Find out how you, too, can meet new people and get paid.
Wait a minute. I'm disturbed.
It's not what you think.
Okay.
But first.
As I mentioned, BP's chief executive, Tony Hayward, of course, he's gotten some negative grades for his handling of the oil spill in the Gulf. And today there are reports BP's board is meeting to discuss his fate. We get the story from Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Hello, Bill.
Tony Hayward did not personally rupture an oil rig, but he may have to go because of the way he handled the situation?
Yes, his PR gaffes, his shaky performance before Congress, he's fatally damaged. Nick McGregor, who's an oil analyst with brokers Redmayne Bentley, says Hayward's departure has been in the cards for at least a couple of months.
Now, I think it happened on May the 27th when Barack Obama said if he worked for me, I'd sack him. Basically, at that point, Barack Obama just destroyed what little credibility he had left and made it a matter of time rather than a maybe.
This move is partly designed to placate the US. The US, after all, is one of BP's most important markets. But the key point here is that Hayward's international credibility is in tatters as a result of the crisis.
And who might receive the enviable position of running BP?
It looks as if it's going to be an American, Bob Dudley, who's currently in charge of BP's operations in the Gulf. To an extent, it's coincidental that he's an American, although it'll certainly help. But analysts say he's probably the best man for the job.
And perhaps the question all Americans want to know, Stephen, what will become of poor Master Hayward?
Well, poor he won't be. It said his pension alone will pay him $750,000 a year, and there'll be an additional lump sum to ease the pain of being fired.
Yes, Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Bill.
There are also reports the person who's expected to replace Hayward is Bob Dudley. He's got 30 years' experience in the industry. He's currently BP's managing director, but he's not entirely scandal-free either. We continue our coverage from London, and the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
Bob Dudley's been running BP's day-to-day response to the oil spill since June. He grew up in Mississippi, and the company says he has a deep appreciation and affinity for the Gulf Coast. Charlie Parker of the news service CityWire says he'd also be a strategic choice for BP.
If they want an American business, if they want to ever drill again, if they ever want again to be treated kindly by Congress, they need a change at the top and they probably need an American.
But Dudley's most high-profile role so far has been as boss of a joint venture between BP and a group of Russian billionaires. It all ended badly, though, when the partners accused him of favouring BP and his visa wasn't renewed. Sandy Lamb is a small BP shareholder.
I find Bob Dudley a strange choice, given the events that happened when he was in charge of TNK-BP, a joint venture with three Russian oligarchs. They hounded him out of Russia.
Dudley will need all the diplomatic skills he has to repair BP's reputation. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
It's been almost 100 days since the oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico began. Millions of gallons and billions of dollars later, and only now are there reports the CEO, Tony Hayward, is being relieved of his executive duties. Reports are that a successor, managing director Bob Dudley, could be named soon. Ralph Ward publishes BoardroomInsider.com. He's with us live from Alma, Michigan. Mr. Ward, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
All right. What has BP accomplished by kicking out Tony Hayward?
It might be their way of putting period to the whole problem. They can say, okay, we have a cap in place. It's working. Now we're past the problem stage. We're getting into the solution stage. And Tony Hayward, despite whatever they may have done, is the face of the problem for the company.
Is that a good strategy to have?
I think it is from a company point of view. Essentially, they're able to say, we have a new face. We made a turnaround. Tony is old news, and he's going to be out. From a corporate governance perspective, I would say if Tony Hayward is leaving today, the independent chair of the board there, Carl Svanberg, should be leaving tomorrow, because the board reaction to the whole situation has not been very well handled at all.
You think they're at the root of it, the foundation of it?
I think so. We're dealing with a British corporation here. The chairman of the board in a European corporation is somewhat different than the way it functions in the U.S. It's a much more powerful public face of the company. Mr. Svanberg, he made the famous "we're looking out for the little people" remark, and that was just one of the problems. Internally, the board, I don't think, has handled the situation well. Immediately, they should have set up an independent board committee to investigate, to monitor the situation, to be the public face of the company. Yeah. We haven't seen anything like that done.
We're going to have to wrap it up there, but Ralph Ward, we do thank you for your time, publisher of BoardroomInsider.com.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, July 26th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Millions of unemployed Americans will be getting checks starting this week. Congress's decision to extend jobless benefits means $34 billion coming to the long-term unemployed through November. Economists say that will be felt in local communities, as reporter April Demboski tells us.
Congress has been wrangling over the extension of benefits for weeks. The Republicans wanted to protect the deficit, while Democrats pushed for stimulating consumer spending. Economist Ralph Martiri is with the bipartisan Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. He says that every dollar of unemployment benefits has the impact of $1.74 in the community. That's because people spend the money rather than save it.
They are desperate. They're letting bills pile up. They got way too many immediate needs to cover just the cost of living to do anything other but spend that money and spend it immediately.
Hazel Feldman is an unemployed social worker. She's been collecting unemployment benefits for almost 2 years. When her checks stopped coming last month, she was on the verge of applying for food stamps.
I've certified the whole month of July and receive nothing. And if I call my account at the Chase Bank, it'll say your balance is zero.
What she wants even more than additional aid is to find a job. I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
It's been 20 years since the first President Bush signed the landmark anti-discrimination law, the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA was designed to do for the disabled what the Civil Rights Act did for racial minorities. Now, when the law was being debated back in 1990, businesses lobbied against it, concerned about costs. How are they feeling now? Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
The benefits from the Disability Act, from wider store aisles to lower light switches to audible elevator signals, helped everyone. But there are no reliable studies on how much businesses have spent on these accommodations, and that makes any cost-benefit analysis impossible. Anecdotally, though, Peter Blank believes the price has been reasonable. Blank is chairman of the Global Universal Design Commission, which comes up with and promotes accessibility standards for buildings.
Well, I'm certainly not aware of a single company that has been put out of business because people with disabilities have been participating in the workforce. The economic benefits are great in terms of productivity, injury prevention, and of course of including workers in the workforce.
Personally, I'd like to say I think it's one of my more prouder achievements.
Randall Johnson was a congressional staffer who worked on the legislation in 1990. Now he supervises labor issues at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he agrees the Disabilities Act was worthwhile, although there are still problems with what he calls drive-by lawsuits.
Lawyers will find a plaintiff and they'll find a merchant who is technically out of compliance, say the size of the bathroom is not quite right or the size of the entrance is an inch off. And that small businessman is forced to settle. If there's a problem, let's give the small employer, the small merchant, a chance to correct that problem.
Disability discrimination complaints are increasing, according to the enforcer of the Disabilities Act, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. There were more than 19,000 cases in 2008, and Chair Jacqueline Berrien expects more as the workforce ages.
Some of the disabilities that might require accommodation are sometimes associated with age. For example, whether it's visual impairments, limited mobility, some of those things may be more common among older workers.
Berrien says businesses have come to support the Disabilities Act because she says tearing down barriers has given them access to a broader range of qualified employees. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, July 26th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org.
Private equity firms are some of the world's biggest risk takers, so the government has been reluctant to let these big investment companies own banks. But as Janet Babin tells us, the new financial regulation law might clear the way.
The new legislation gives big investors more latitude to invest in banks. And Apollo Global Management isn't waiting. The Financial Times reports it plans to open a bank called Ares. For private equity firms like Apollo, with lots of cash to invest, banks could become the next big moneymaker, so long as regulators allow it. Chris Whalen's with bank rating agency Institutional Risk Analytics.
The private equity firms have been very unhappy because they haven't been allowed into the party. So this is a new evolution that allows the fund to have a piece of the pie, and then they have investors who are separate shareholders.
Whalen says the investors will have to confirm to regulators that they're not acting as a group. That would still be illegal. Apollo has hired bankers from Countrywide Financial to set up the new bank. That name might sound familiar. The mortgage side of Countrywide gained notoriety during the housing meltdown for its failed subprime loans. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Today, libraries in Los Angeles County, California are cutting hours. Also starting today, fewer bus routes in Phoenix. And other cities are planning to raise their rates for public transit, all a part of local areas across the country slashing budgets. But that's not the worst of it, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
It seems that no form of city funding is safe. Property taxes have dropped, along with housing values, and consumer spending is down, which hurts a city's sales taxes.
Almost all local revenues are being affected in some way.
That's Chris Haney with the National League of Cities. He says an overwhelming majority of American cities are cutting staff.
If they don't have the personnel there, they can't run the transit service, they can't staff the libraries. And they're closing libraries and recreation centers, so it translates into visible service cuts.
In some cases, the cuts are more than visible. They're potentially dangerous.
We're at the point where cities are making cuts in police and firefighters.
Budget cuts come with a silver lining for some bus riders in Scottsdale, Arizona. The city hired a new contractor for one route. It saves money by not charging fares. Apparently, the expense of collecting and counting fares outweighs the profit, so the bus ride is now free. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We're still awaiting word on what the National Hockey League Players Association proposes about Ilya Kovalchuk's contract. The league rejected the New Jersey Devils offer to keep the 27-year-old star forward in an historic 17-year deal. Now, that deal front-loads most of the money in the contract period so the team doesn't break its salary cap. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan says it's just another way of going overboard in the financial games being played in sports. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
Going overboard, I thought, was supposed to be sort of paired by these salary caps that are in certain sports. Why isn't that working?
Well, because it's wonderful. It's like looking at Wall Street, because you have these salary caps, but the teams figure out ways around the caps, and it turns out there's a whole kind of specialist called a capologist. I love that name. And the capologists figure out ways to deal with the salary cap and still get what you want.
For example?
For example, we have this guy, Kovalchuk, and over 12 years, he's making, I think, $95 million. It's $8 million a year. But the last 5 years, he gets paid almost nothing, so the number drops to six.
So his average salary will be under the cap. I get that. But Alan, come on. This is America, and we want our teams to do well. Are there any downsides to all this manipulating?
Well, there are if you care about competitive balance and home teams being able to hold players. But, hey, I'm from New York, okay? I grew up in Brooklyn, rooting for the New York Yankees. I'm a classic front runner. I just want I'm saying this with a big smile because I don't want to be stoned, but what I care about is if my teams can get the players they need to win and let the other players and teams take care of themselves.
So what's the moral of the story, Alan?
That numbers are numbers in sports land, just like on Wall Street. You don't necessarily believe what they're showing you.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan joining us from New York. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
And finally, if in your business travels you've ever been to a strange town, chances are you could have used a friend.
Rentafriend.com is strictly platonic. It charges anywhere from $20 to $50 an hour for someone to show you around or just to join you at dinner.
Well, then you and your new friend have to figure something out.
And what would that be?
Who's going to pick up the tab?
Ah, yes. Yeah. There's that.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.